You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. A lot going on. Boy, this talk about a headline. States not expanding Medicaid. You know, these are the states that are saying no thanks to the president's, to Obamacare's will help out your poor people program. Texas is, I think, the biggest. Texas, Florida, and Georgia. Texas is turning down $9.6 billion this year. Florida, $5 billion. Georgia, $2.9 billion. Virginia, $2.8 billion. North Carolina, $2.6 billion. Net, it's incredible. It's incredible. $35 billion total that these guys are leaving on the table. And it's their money. I mean, the taxpayers of Texas paid federal income taxes and sent that money off to Washington, D.C. And then Washington, D.C. says, we're going to send some of that money back to you in the form of you know, health care for poor people. And the governor says, no, we don't want the money. You guys keep it. What's conservative about that? I don't get it. What's even Republican about that? It's just, this is just, you know, we hate Obama. And if his name is attached to it, we're going to do it. But anyhow, Daniel Rothschild was on the line with us. Daniel is a senior fellow with the R Street Institute, founded by former Heartland Institute staffers. rstreet.org is the website. His Twitter is Dan Rothschild, or at RSI. Dan, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much for having me on.
You wrote a piece that my dad could have written. It's called The Oil Spill Windfall, A Test for Republicans in the Weekly Standard. And I find it absolutely fascinating. If I can summarize, and you tell me if I've got the essence of your piece or not.
Sure.
The, you know, BP basically screwed the Gulf. And these five Gulf states are getting billions of dollars from BP as part of the settlement in order to remediate, to clean up the mess and fix the environment to the extent that it's possible to do, and in some ways the economy as well, and some to the extent that it's possible to do. These states are all run by Republicans, Republican governors, Republican legislatures. And you're looking at Alabama. What is it? Alabama, Georgia, Mississippi, Louisiana, and Florida. I'm guessing.
Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana, Texas.
Texas. Okay, cool. And the essence of your article, if I have it right, is that these Republicans, if they take this money and they spend it appropriately by actually cleaning up the environment and actually putting the economy back to work, will demonstrate that good government, conservative good government, not creating any new permanent you talk about permanent bureaucracies, not establishing any new programs that will survive past the money that BP gives. In other words, an expandable, collapsible program that good government can actually work. Have I summarized, encapsulated your article accurately?
I think that's a fairly fair assessment of it. I think that the challenge facing the governors and the legislators in the Gulf Coast is to learn and figure out how to use the Restore Act windfall, which is going to be anywhere between $4 billion and $18 billion, depending on what a federal judge in New Orleans decides. Take this money and use it responsibly in a way that invests in the economy and in the ecology of the Gulf Coast. And I think that it's something that can be done.
Now, you realize that when David Frum started talking about this, I mean, he's told me this story a couple of times on the air. When he started talking about Republicans spending money responsibly or investing in things, like you actually mentioned infrastructure, you used that word, I believe, in your article, that he got basically kicked out of the Republican Party and was banned by most of the conservative publications. The government should not be doing these things. Government should be doing nothing.
Well, I think what's interesting about this is that this is not taxpayer money. This is money that is being paid by BP pursuant and to Transocean, the operator of the rig, pursuant to the Clean Water Act. But Congress decided on a bipartisan basis in 2012 that rather than taking that money and doing what they would do with it under existing law, which is Washington holding on to it and using it for a variety of different things, that they take 80% of that money and send it directly to the states that were affected.
Right. So the distinction is that when conservatives say, we should not invest in our intellectual infrastructure, in our kids with free college. We should not invest in our roads and bridges, our physical infrastructure. We should not invest in new schools. It's because they're talking about tax dollars. But when you say Republican governors should invest in the wetlands and the shrimping areas and the Gulf Coast, basically, that's okay because it's a fine that BP is paying rather than a tax.
I think what's important here is that this is money that is a judge is going to decide how much exactly BP should be fined for this. And this money is going to go somewhere, and it's going to be spent on something. So it's not like we're having an argument about spending on something versus reducing the tax burden on somebody else. This is money that is going to be in the bank sooner rather than later. And it's incumbent upon legislators and governors and counties and parishes in the coastal states that are going to be getting the money to figure out the best and most effective ways to use it.
Yeah, I agree with you.
A significant part of that is going to be on infrastructure building.
My prediction, respectfully, Daniel, is that when these Republican governors get their hands on this money, you're going to see the exact same thing happen that has happened when Republicans and frankly Democrats to some extent, but certainly Republicans over the last couple of decades, get their hands on large amounts of money. You're going to see no bid contracts going to crony Republican donating companies. You're going to see Halliburton doing work to clean up the mess that they themselves created, for which their people should be in jail. I mean, 11 people died. And it's not going to play out the way that you're suggesting it should.
I completely agree with you that it is a bipartisan phenomenon that when legislators and governors get large piles of money, they don't always spend it in the most appropriate ways. But I think, for example, if you look at Louisiana, for the last several years, they've been developing a long-term coastal plan that says, how do we fix the coast of Louisiana? When you're losing a football field of marshland every hour, that means that the cities and towns of southern Louisiana are getting closer and closer to the coast.
Right.
So everyone there, Republicans, Democrats, conservatives, liberals, business groups, workers groups, realize that this is an issue that's going to have to be dealt with. And I think that the Jindal administration has put together a really sound, sensible plan for doing this. And I have very high hopes that they're going to
But they're
the
being trashed by the Tea Party for doing it, you know.
Tom, I have not heard any criticism from the Tea Party or anyone else about this. And that's precisely why I wrote this article, is because this is something that's important for conservatives and conservationists to like. There's a lot of opportunity, I think, to do a lot of good here, and the Jindal administration, for one, certainly recognizes that.
Yeah. Well, I will be very impressed, and I don't disagree with you that it would be a good thing if this money is appropriately used, and in particular if it goes – in fact, I would add to what you wrote that some of this should go – since this is damages – some of it should go directly to the human being whose lives have been damaged. I mean, you've got small business people, you've got people who are out of work, you've got families whose lives have been devastated, you've got an explosion in cancer rates along that coast. Shouldn't some of that money be going to those people?
Well, those people were primarily, there was money that was set aside from a criminal settlement. BP paid actually a record-level criminal settlement, and that was what that money is for. And there are other processes for these things. This is, the Restore Act is just money that is being paid under the Clean Water Act.
To restore the Gulf.
Right.
Yeah.
And the legislation is very clear, and I stress again, it's bipartisan legislation. In the House, it was sponsored by Steve Scalise, who certainly wouldn't call him a liberal. The legislation reflects both conservative and conservationist values, and I think it's something where we don't have to be particularly partisan, and we can come together. And
wouldn't it be incredible if the Teddy Roosevelt wing of the Republican Party was to rise again?
I think this is an opportunity for Republicans to show what they haven't talked about nearly enough, which is that Republicans do value the environment. I mean, bear in mind that Louisiana says on their license plates that they're a sportsman's paradise.
Right.
It's about using the environment responsibly.
Well, let's hope so. Daniel Rothschild, I salute you. A well-written piece. rstreet.org is the website. And the piece was over in the Weekly Standard. It's called The Oil Spill Windfall, a Test for Republicans. Daniel, thanks for dropping by.
Thanks for having me on.
Good talking.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Responsible Republicans. Two words that recently haven't fit in the same sentence. And welcome back. Dr. Nate is with us. Nate Sweet.
Hey, how's it going, Tom?
How you doing, Nate?
I'm doing all right.
So, on the big picture tonight at 7 o'clock Eastern Time, 6 o'clock Central Time, 5 o'clock Mountain Time, 4 o'clock Pacific Time, I don't know what time that is in Hawaii, but I know we have viewers there.
Something even earlier.
Yeah, there you go. We are going to start out with a rant about how what's going on in Detroit right now is the Republican beta test for how to rip off big cities, particularly large cities with large minority populations, and you know, people who are just beginning to climb out of poverty, people who are more vulnerable to predation by banksters, but who still have some assets left.
Right, and you know, one of the remarkable things is the city's actually considering selling out some of its the wonderful masterpieces in the Detroit Institute of Art, but also considering selling out the Kevin Ora's thrown or suggested that he's interested in selling out the water department. There's also this ongoing right-wing plan to buy up Belle Isle Park in the city and to turn it into this libertarian gambling paradise, which is truly bizarre, something out of an Ayn Rand novel. But what I think is remarkable here is that you're already seeing Republicans taking stock of what's going on in Detroit, and even some Democrats, too. I mean, Illinois passed a pension reform plan yesterday that guts that state's pension programs from and takes money away from retirees. I think Republicans are taking notice, and this is the new austerity package that they're going to be pushing throughout the country.
Yeah, although Republican, you know, in Michigan, it's being done with a meat axe, basically. They're stripping Detroit. They're stripping it the way Bain Capital used to.
Right.
In Illinois, I think it's more of a, you've had really, frankly, bad governance for years and years and years. I mean, you know, two of their last four governors are in prison right now. And Democrats, let's acknowledge, but you know, bad governance by both parties in that state, and a fairly corrupt city administration, Democratic, the Daley administration, and that chicken is coming home to roost.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are differences definitely between the two situations.
But at least in Illinois, they're trying to clean it up in a way that doesn't hurt the little guy and that doesn't just make opportunities for rich people, period.
Right.
Which is very much what they're doing in D.C., Detroit.
Yeah, it's pretty much just a fire sale.
D.C. in our second block, and Mike Papantonio is going to be on, and he's going to be riffing on this. In our second block, in our B block, Washington, D.C. and California have some rather significant differences when it comes to medical marijuana. Tell me about this.
Right. So D.C., unlike California, actually makes you sign this waiver that the federal government has the right to prosecute you and arrest you because of marijuana possession. I think what most people don't realize is despite medical marijuana being legal in D.C., marijuana itself is not legal. It still exists within this. There's medical marijuana in most places, except for obviously Washington, Colorado, still exists within this weird legal loophole. So Rabbi Jeffrey Kahn, the proprietor of the Tacoma Wellness Center just outside of D.C. in Tacoma, Maryland, will be sort of explaining us the differences between the two medical marijuana programs. And
now, is that a dispensary in Tacoma?
It's a medical marijuana. Yeah, it's a
How can you have a dispensary in Tacoma when it's legal in D.C.? Oh, because medical marijuana is legal in Maryland also.
Yes.
Okay. So his dispensary, if you live in Maryland, you don't have to sign the giant form, but if you live in D.C., you do. Is that the deal?
Double checking on that. Not sure about that just yet, but we will definitely ask him about it.
That would be interesting to find out. And to find out why he hasn't opened a satellite branch in D.C., because I know that there are no medical marijuana dispensaries, or I believe there are none in D.C. I think it's interesting. Anyway, and lots more to come in the big picture tonight. Nate, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Tom.
Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. Well, that was interesting. I originally thought I was going to debate Daniel, and then I read his piece, and I thought, holy cow, you know, he's asking. He actually says in his article, this money needs to be spent transparently. And I'm like, have you talked to Scott Walker recently? The Jindal administration is, maybe responsible Republicans will come along. Who knows? Commodity trackers flee for surging stocks. This is in the Financial Times right now. It's the lead story. Or, one of the top three on their website, that basically commodities, gold, oil, wheat, pork bellies, I mean, you name it, principally the precious metals and things like that are crashing. And the question is, are they crashing because of a lack of demand? Are they crashing, or are they crashing because the stock market is surging? And the headline kind of gives that one away. Commodity trackers flee for surging stocks. In other words, people are taking their money out of gold, for example, and they're putting it into the stock market. And this is what I was predicting in my crash, my book, The Crash of 2016, that, you know, they're going to just keep inflating this bubble, and they're going to try and do it until November 2016, until after the elections. And I don't think it's going to, I don't think they're going to be able to pull it off. But, interesting. And it's a good time. In my mind, you see these kind of 20-year long cycles of stocks and then commodities and then stocks and then commodities. And back, well, roughly 20 years ago, maybe a little longer, a friend of mine told me about this, and he said, you know, now would be a good time to buy some gold. And so I bought gold, and when it was like, I think $200 an ounce, $230 an ounce, we bought some gold. And you know, actually, I'm still sitting on most of it. And although I've sold any of the gold stocks that I had. And then, you know, the commodities fade and the stock market comes in. And so right now you've got the stock market booming. I don't think these are 20-year cycles anymore, though. I think those cycles were back when we had a top income tax rate above 74%. I think what we're seeing right now is speculative bubbles rather than normal cycles. And so I'm, as much as possible, moving into cash. If I had a lot of money, if I was investing in the stock market, I would probably be putting it in the German stock market right now, frankly. But, there's another piece in the Financial Times. Large investors turn cold on commodities. Basically, what they're saying is that the price of gold is going to start falling, has fallen over the last year, and it's going to start falling substantially, which would not surprise me at all. On the other hand, I think, you know, eventually it's going to come back. But where, what's it going to come back to, and where it's going to come, I don't know. This is microeconomics and investment stuff, which I don't know and I don't do well. More welfare for Wall Street. This is incredible. And this demonstrates, in my mind, what I have been saying, for a long, long time about the new American business model, how, you know, all the main street businesses and all the mom and pop businesses and the strip malls and the downtowns that used to be there are all gone, and they've all been replaced by these big box stores and whatnot. In part, they're gone because in 82, Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act. But in part, they're gone because mom-and-pop businesses that pay their employees a decent wage can't compete with a big transnational corporation whose business model is to pay its employees so little that they qualify for food stamps and thus and home heating assistance in the winter and Medicaid and things like that, and thus the taxpayers are picking up a large part of the tab of the labor costs for these big companies. Now, everybody is figuring this out. I mean, I've been saying this for years. It's in my book, Screwed, which was published about 5 years ago, and I think it's still a very good contemporary analysis of the political situation. And I've been writing about it for a lot longer than that, but, I mean, explicitly I laid it out in Screwed as a new business model. But, and recently Americans are seeing this happen in things like Walmart. The average Walmart in America costs the local community $1 million in subsidies for its employees. We kick in $1 million for their employees, and then they kick in $1 million or whatever it is, and, you know, so they pay a low wage, and then we pay enough to take that person up above the poverty level or up to the point where they can survive. So everybody figured out Walmart's up to this. We've got this strike that's going on today, the fast food strikes, and McDonald's around the country, they're going, oh, yeah, these are paid organizers and activists and ne'er-do-wells and hippies and... Actually, they're probably not calling them hippies. There's a lot of people of color there, so they're probably calling them even worse words. Thugs for the unions. No, they are low-wage workers. And McDonald's, part of the profits, part of the billions of dollars in profits that McDonald's makes, is coming from your tax dollars supporting McDonald's workers, health care, and food stamps and things like that. An old friend of mine, I don't know if you want me to use his name, so I'm not, but he used to live in what was called Rio Rancho in San Diego. It was the wealthiest zip code in the United States. He had this $12 million mansion. He's a British multimillionaire. And it's a long story how I met this guy. But anyhow, we've become pretty good friends. And Louise and I were out visiting, staying in his guest home. You know, it's a community that has its own private fire department. And just down the street was Ray Kroc's widow's house, this probably $15 million mansion, Mrs. Kroc. I don't begrudge her the money. But I do think that this business model of McDonald's, well, is not right. But there's a twist to this. I'll tell you right after this voice.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
It's not just fast food and Walmart. One in three bank tellers are now on public assistance. It's everywhere. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Yep, one in three bank tellers are on public assistance. And see, it's not just bank tellers. I had to go to Macy's. This has been, a year and a half ago, 2 years ago. I was invited to have dinner with President Obama and his wife and 200 of their best friends. It was the TV correspondence dinner. And I had to have a tuxedo. And this was the second time I'd been invited to one of these things, and I figured I live in Washington, D.C., because I had to have a tuxedo for the presidential inauguration, and I rented one. And when you rent a tux, it's like, you know, $80 or $90, something like that. I mean, it's not cheap to rent a nice-looking tuxedo. And so I went over to Macy's to see, you know, maybe I should just buy one. Because if I'm going to wear it more than three times, I've probably paid for, you know, and there's a huge hassle associated with renting a tux. I mean, you got to go in, you got to get fitted, you got to come back, you got to return it, you got to, you know, all this stuff. And I already had a pair of black shoes. They weren't the right kind, but I don't care. And I wanted to learn how to tie a bow tie. I'd never done that. So anyhow, I went over to Macy's and very, very, very smart young man, very nice young man. Showed me the tuxes, and they actually had them on sale, and it was like one of the designer ones, like Ralph Lauren or something, and it was $150 for a tux. And you know, thank God, I have enough income. I realize that's a lot of money for a lot of people. It's a lot of money for me, frankly, but still, I thought, okay. You know, I'll invest in the tux, and that way, you know, if I wear this thing three times, and I have worn it three times since then, I've saved money on renting. And as I'm buying the tux, I'm saying to this guy who's just striking me as one of the smartest people, you know, very thoughtful, very considerate, just a gentleman, a young man. Yeah, I'd guess he was 25. Just a sweet guy. I said, you know, what do you think about working at Macy's? Just figured I'd ask. And he said, well, actually, I'm a lawyer, but I can't get a job. And I said, you're a lawyer, you can't get a job in Washington, D.C.? And he said, yeah. He said, I actually, you know, I graduated from law school with honors. I passed the bar. He said, there are a few opportunities occasionally that pop up, but they're not necessarily things that are going to go anywhere. He was African American. He said, "I'm black. I've got one strike against me," and you know, which is tough to hear. And I mean, it's a tough reality in America. And but a lawyer at Macy's. And then the cartoon yesterday. This cartoon. I don't know if you saw the Doonesbury cartoon in the newspaper, where the Doonesbury's daughter or granddaughter or whatever it is now. You know, Doonesbury's like an old man like me. And so the kid, she's now a college graduate. She's working in a fast food restaurant with her as she's working on her PhD. and she's training the new girl who's just been hired, you know. And she's explaining to her, I got my master's degree or I got my PhD or whatever, and I just couldn't find a job, so here I am working at McDonald's and or fed this fast food joint. And she says, "What's your story?" And the young woman who she's training says, "Same story here. My PhD is in microbiology." This is a lost generation. The peak of wealth in the United States was 1973. 1973, Richard Nixon was president, and he put together this very complex deal that allowed countries to start exporting textiles to each other, including the United States. Now, there were a lot of quotas, but there were ways around those quotas. And Daewoo, a South Korean company, in fact, got into bed with a Bangladeshi company so that they could double their quotas, and hooked up with other countries, companies in other countries, and started just pumping stuff into the United States, and we stopped making things here. We stopped making clothing here. Richard Nixon also helped cut taxes on corporations. You know, I've been saying for years, it all began with Reagan. I'm increasingly thinking it all began with Nixon. And Reagan was when it became naked. Because when Nixon traveled around the country, he gave speeches about how he was trying to help the textile industry by putting quotas on what could be imported in the United States, because we had tariffs back then. But he was going to punch holes through those tariffs in small quantities. Right. Do we still make socks in South Carolina? Do we still make blue jeans in New Mexico? Do we still make ladies' dresses in Southern California? Do we still make men's suits in Manhattan? No. There's a fancy tailor shop just up the street from our TV show, from our TV studio. And I was in there shopping around the other day. Actually, it was about a year ago. And I said, "Can I buy a sports coat from you made in the United States?" And, I mean, this is a fancy place. I mean, everything is custom made. You don't buy something off the rack here. And the guy said, "No, sorry. I can sell you stuff made in Canada. So it's made in North America. We have some very good men's suits. Samuelson, I think, was the brand." He said, "They're made in Canada, but not in the United States." They do sell shirts made in the United States. Actually, I'm wearing one of them right now. With a little bit of lint on it. Anyway. So I bought a shirt from them. But that was about it. This is one of these you got to look good on TV things. Anyhow, end of story. The point is that we just don't make things here anymore, and there's no good jobs anymore. And this little tailor shop where I bought this shirt is here in D.C. There's still a lot of small locally owned businesses. This is a family owned shop. It's the father and son own the business. And I was talking to the son. These two guys run the store. They're tailors. They make clothes. It's pretty much gone. I mean, that's pretty much gone. Now it's back to Macy's, where lawyers are working for so little that they're probably qualifying for food stamps. This is the new American business model. And, you know, here's the story by Bill Moyers and Company. This is from the Washington Post, actually. Almost a third of the country's 500,000 bank tellers rely on some form of public assistance. Taxpayers are doling out nearly $90 million a year to supplement the wages of bank tellers. Which also raises the question, do you want to be giving your most confidential financial information to somebody who's in financial distress? Which raises the question of, is even raising that question really a nasty form of bigotry? Because on the one hand, you've got, you know, it implies that people who are on the lower end of the economic strata are more likely to be criminal, which is something I completely reject, and is an argument that has been used to support racism and perpetuate poverty for millennia. And on the other hand, somebody who's in economic distress, as you can find by checking out your jail populations, is actually somewhat more likely to be a risk. And I guess I'm contradicting myself. I'm, you know, it's like, how do you do that and be politically correct? I don't know. Sharon in Bellingham, Washington. Your thoughts, Sharon?
Hi. I don't, you know, I don't have time or the skills for a lot of activism, but I called the White House today. Pretty much is calling the White House or my senators and representatives. And my question to the White House was, given Obama's speech yesterday, how does he sync this with the TPP? Because to me, his talk about not offshoring jobs, narrowing income inequality and all of this, and his stance with the TPP are totally contradictory to each other, and I'm just wondering what you think, and what is my best way to get this word out to him?
Well, I think you did it. You call the White House comment line. They actually do keep track of those calls. The key is to make it a single message call so that they can just check a box or, you know, so that, because if the message starts getting complex, then it'll get lost. And don't expect that you're going to get an answer from the president. Secondly, you can write a letter to them, which they take very seriously, by the way. They take letters like, you know, 100 times or 1,000 times more seriously than they do calls, and they take calls 1,000 times more seriously than they do emails. And third, you can go to the Organizing for America, I think it's called, what used to be the Obama for America, OFA, website, which is basically the Obama campaign. It's the remnant of the Obama campaign. And they've got good hooks into the White House, and you can make your comments known. And you know, any social media that you're a part of, any message board that you're a part of, start leaving comments. If you subscribe to an online publication like the New York Times, you can make a comment on articles and things. And you can, I mean, there's a lot of ways to say these things, Sharon. You just did it right now. You just did it, to 2.5-3 million people by calling a radio show. So that's good stuff. It's good stuff. Keep it up. Because I agree with you. I think that, thank you for the call. I think that the president's position on the TPP, well, actually, we don't fully know his position on the TPP, but it seems that he's very supportive of it. And if he is, then that is at odds with his speech yesterday. We'll be back 15 minutes before the end.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Unless the TPP would be so radically changed, but there's no way that is ever going to happen. We need to pull out of these trade wars. Welcome back. Steve in Phoenix, Arizona, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Just a few things I'd like to touch on here. One, I'm eagerly awaiting your two books. Did them on the last promotion. So
oh, great. Thank you.
Reviews sound great from what the people say. The other quick thing. We got to return to the 74% tax rate and tighten up the tariffs and the top marginal tax rate. That's imperative, and we've got to tighten up our tariffs on the goods coming in and out of the country and stuff.
Yeah, this is not rocket science. You know, for 200 years, this country ran really, really well with an average 30% tariff, and sometimes as high as 35%. And and now it's 2%.
Yeah, it's we gotta work on that. Our new Pope is fantastic. Even Bill Maher, you know, who I've seen you on his show, you know, he loves him. You know,
yeah.
And frankly, that's the only reason I have HBO is to watch Bill.
Yeah.
The Pope's been talking about income inequality and a lot of the problems we've got in our country, and this fast food strike that's going on today. I haven't seen any coverage on MSN today. On the internet site about it, but I know what's going on. And what I wanted to talk about that is a couple years ago, you played a clip that I'd requested, When Does the Greed Stop by Teddy Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
It deals with the minimum wage.
Right.
And you really liked it.
Yeah.
Would you possibly be able to find that again?
Shane is looking right now and is, did you find it, Shane? It's there? Okay.
$240 billion in tax breaks for corporations. $36 billion in tax breaks for small businesses. Increase in productivity, 42% over the last 10 years. But do you think there's any increase in the minimum wage? No. What is the price? We ask the other side. What is the price that you want from these working men and women? What cost? How much more do we have to give to the private sector and to business? How much, many billion dollars more are you asking? Are you requiring? When does the greed stop?
There you go, Steve.
Fantastic. Thanks so much, Tom. I'll let you move on to other people.
Okay. Thanks a lot for the call. That's brilliant. I'm going to play that again in a couple of minutes. I that's worth repeating. Dave, in Armstrong Creek, Wisconsin, watching Free Speech TV on Dish Network, you have a very short quote about inequality.
Yes, I got actually several.
We have 1 minute.
I'm going to read them to you, and then you probably know where they came from. There's enough wealth in the world for everyone's needs, but not enough for everyone's greed. Hmm. That's the first one. And there are seven sins in this world. Wealth without work, pleasure without conscience, knowledge without character, commerce without morality, science without humanity, worship without sacrifice, and politics without principle.
Wow.
You know where those came from?
No. I've heard them before, but I don't remember.
Mahatma Gandhi.
Ah, yeah. Of course. Of course.
Yeah, they're really relevant, I think. Pretty much says it all about what's going on right now.
And you know what's so sad is that Gandhi was a great spokesperson for the working people, and Martin Luther King was a great spokesperson for the working people, and the wealthy history book publishers have basically turned Gandhi into the guy who was pro-independence and Martin Luther King into the guy who was, you know, pro-civil rights, and totally forgotten that both of them were also there for the working people, all working people. 10 minutes before the hour, let's step into the Wayback Machine with Sherman here and listen to the late Senator Ted Kennedy asking, well, when does the greed stop? Here he is. Let me just set this up. He's talking about raising the minimum wage. Today, all across the nation, these strikes are going on to raise the minimum wage, to raise the pay in these low-wage industries, raising the minimum wage. Here's Teddy Kennedy.
$240 billion in tax breaks for corporations, $36 billion in tax breaks for small businesses, increase in productivity, 42% over the last 10 years. But do you think there's any increase in the minimum wage? No. What is the price? We ask the other side. What is the price that you want from these working men and women? What cost? How much more do we have to give to the private sector and to business? How many billion dollars more are you asking? Are you requiring? When does the greed stop?
That was 2007. Just before the crash, during the Bush administration, hundreds of billions of dollars in tax cuts to the biggest corporations in the world, tens of billions of dollars in tax cuts to the Mitt Romneys of the world. Nothing, literally nothing to minimum wage workers. When does the greed stop? Thomas in Flint, Michigan. Hey, Thomas, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I apologize for my high voice. I didn't inherit my father's English accent. I am one of those government statistics that the GOP rails about that Jesus isn't down with. I'm on food stamps. I live in Flint. Mm. I'm lucky to get what I get. And I can feed myself and get the help that I need to find a job. But can we change the narrative and stop calling it a minimum wage worker and start calling it, and I did a hashtag for this, a no wage worker, because that's what these people like me are. Yeah. People are no wage workers.
Thomas, the reason why I wouldn't do that is because there is a huge trend in this country of people taking no pay internships. And there are literally millions of young people, most of them within 3 years of college, who are working for nothing in the biggest corporations in America, and in some cases small companies, but the big companies seem to get away with it a whole lot more efficiently, and calling them internship. And those people literally are no-wage workers, and we can't forget them either. Pardon my...
I understand, but they're working for an education.
No, they're not. These are people who have already graduated. These are people who are... You know, the big companies have said, you want a job here? We just don't pay you the first couple of years.
I understand, but I'm so sick of what you were railing on and ranting about the narrative and how we never call out Martin Bashir getting fired
right.
or saying poo on the air. Nobody ever calls out Bill O'Reilly and Rush Limbaugh with the slut comment and everything else.
Yeah.
And I'm so sick of libs like me having to roll over because nobody except you and Norman Goldman have a backbone and like Cenk have a backbone to get off their butt and actually scream from the rooftops without calling them a liar and like insulting the president while he's giving a speech and actually, you know, take them to task for it.
Thomas, thank you for the comments. I'm with you, and I love the hashtag no wage worker. I think though that we can't forget these interns. It's a horrible thing, but low wage worker, minimum wage worker, this movement is naming itself right now. I'm not going to try and Frank Luntz them. But I agree with you that there is something so vicious about this business model that has been promulgated on the United States during this era of Reaganomics that it needs a phrase that's even more powerful than what we have. And by the way, I think your voice is great. Thomas, thank you for calling. Joe, in driving through Indiana. Hey, Joe, you wanted to disagree with me?
I was just wondering, like, if you pay everybody at McDonald's $15 an hour.
Right.
Like, you're going to have to pay the kids, you know, in high school that amount, too.
Why? The average age of people working in the fast food industry is 28.
Yeah, but there's a lot of kids that work through high school.
Not so much anymore. Not so much anymore. These are people who are trying to raise families. This is the thing, Joe. Maybe you're living in a part of America that wasn't affected by Reaganomics, but most of America now, you don't, you know, get a job through high school. You might get a free job, or you might, you know, get some kind of local, very, very low paid job, but it just is not the country it used to be. The peak of wealth of this country was in 1973, and we have been on a downhill slide, with the exception of the top 1%, who are richer than they have ever been in the history of the world, including the Roman Republic. I mean, they are richer than the emperors of ancient Rome, the top 1% of Americans. And with the exception of that group, the American middle class has been just devastated by Reaganomics.
I guess what I'm saying is, you know, being a truck driver, I started out my job at $15 an hour.
Right.
I am a hazmat licensed driver.
Right.
I drive.
What year was
gasoline.
That? What year was that you were making $15 an hour?
That was like 4 years ago.
4 years ago. Okay. See, I think it's crazy that we're paying truck drivers $15 an hour. You should have started at $20 an hour, you know, or $25 an hour.
Well, I work.
Especially
work
if you're driving gasoline
company.
Around. I mean, you've got my life in your hands.
I understand that. But, you know, I've worked for a smaller company that maybe can't afford to pay everybody that
much. Well, they can afford to pay it, Joe. It's just that the CEO might have to take home a little more, take home a little less, or the stockholders might have to take home a little less. We are not a poor country. We are not a poor country. Joe, thank you for the call. We'll be back. It's coming up on the top of the hour. Mr. Cole.
Listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. EdisonFactor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartmann.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartmann.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartmann here with you, and on the line with us, on the wire with us, on the magic machine with us, Mike Papantonio, attorney, host of Ring of Fire Radio, ringoffireradio.com. How you doing, Pap?
Ed, I'm doing fine, Tom. You know, I just great holiday. How about yours?
We had a really nice time. We were orphans this year. We weren't able to get out to visit my brothers in Michigan or our kids in Portland, so we just visited some of the other orphans who live in our marina and just visited a couple of people's boats and shared meals with them and had a nice time. It was a nice time. So, Ring of Fire Radio, you are pretty fit. Today, we've got this strike going on all across the United States with the McDonald's and low-wage workers.
Right.
And now we find that it's not just the low-wage workers.
Yeah, I mean, lately...
it's not just the fast food industry.
Everybody's been paying attention to the fast food industry because, I mean, the numbers are staggering. 52% of the families that were the main money earner is working at a fast food restaurant. Of those 52%, they're on some type of public assistance. It comes to $7 billion a year that taxpayers are having to pick up the tab for. But, you know, lately we're seeing that there's a lot more to this story. It's not just the fast food industry. One-third, this is an amazing number, but one-third of all the people who work as bank tellers in the United States rely on public assistance. Now, that's costing taxpayers, just that little part of the economy, $900 million a year. $100 million is spent on food stamps. This is for bank tellers, Tom.
Right.
$500 million spent for Medicaid. You know, we have to take care of their families with their children in need. And so the point is this. This is all taking place when the CEOs of chief executives in the lower rungs of the management of the food industry are making $500,000 a year, while a bank teller is making somewhere around $24,000. So the high cost to taxpayers of this is that the cost is we're paying for another industry's low wage, and it's simply externalizing this industry, the banking industry, just like the fast food industry, is externalizing their risks, their overhead, their bad conduct to taxpayers.
Yeah.
So they socialize all the bad and internalize all the good.
Yeah. I think a lot of this came out of, and I don't want to blame this all on Bill Clinton, because obviously, this is Reaganomics on steroids. Reaganomics has gutted the middle class. But when Clinton and Gingrich got together and said, let's, and I think from Clinton's point of view, probably with the best of intentions, let's stop multi-generational welfare. Let's require after at least 4 years that people can no longer get welfare unless they get a job. But we know that those jobs are going to be tough and they're going to be, low paying. And so we'll continue to provide benefits to people if they have a job. Then what happened was American business said, oh, here's a brand new business model for us. The government will pay people benefits if they're working for us, but only if our pay is below a certain amount. So let's start paying below that amount.
Right, right.
Does this make sense to you?
Well, I mean, it's a great business plan, Tom. If you're running a corporation, it's the equivalent. It's easier to understand this way. If a corporation that pollutes our rivers or our air or with toxins, they pollute our public commons with this toxic mess. Unless taxpayers spend money to clean that up, it never gets cleaned up. And this is the equivalent here. In other words, the corporation makes their profit by externalizing or moving these things that they should be doing to taxpayers.
Right.
So it's a disaster for taxpayers. It's wonderful for corporate America. But your point about Bill Clinton, if you go back and take a look at when and why Bill Clinton made these big concessions to Wall Street, that's what these concessions were. It wasn't Newt Gingrich who made him do this. It was Wall Street. And I think it's very difficult to put a positive spin on the Clinton legacy, because all what he did is he continued the lie, Tom. He knew it was a lie. He understood that the average single mom trying to raise four children out there was not exactly living the life of Riley. He also understood that yes, there are people that abuse the system. But do they abuse the system to where it costs the taxpayers as much money as Wall Street when Wall Street abuses the system?
Right.
We know abuse is going to take place. So the question then becomes, do we allow the abuse to take place at the bottom, because it's far less? It's far less money. It's far less incident. But the money that you give to people at the bottom is going to move up. The money that you give to the Wall Street abuser will rarely move down. So Bill Clinton knew all this. He's not a dummy,
yeah.
But this is all for Wall Street. It was a Wall Street show. The same thing we can expect from Hillary as she starts her presidential campaign.
Yeah. And this has been going on for, you know, a long, long time. Occasionally somebody speaks out. Did you hear Teddy Kennedy? I've got about a 20-second clip. May I play it for you?
Of course.
This is 2000. I'm sorry. Oh, Shane says he needs 10 seconds to queue it up. This is from 2007, and this is after the Bush administration had given over $300 billion in tax cuts to the biggest corporations. They had given over $30 billion in tax cuts to, quote, small businesses, which include things like Koch Industries. They had given billions and billions of dollars to the Mitt Romneys of the world. And Teddy Kennedy is asking the question, why not raise the minimum wage? When does the greed stop? Here it is.
$240 billion in tax breaks for corporations, $36 billion in tax breaks for small businesses, increase in productivity 42% over the last 10 years. But do you think there's any increase in the minimum wage? No. What is the price? We ask the other side. What is the price that you want from these working men and women? What cost? How much more do we have to give to the private sector and to business? How many billion dollars more are you asking? Are you requiring? When does the greed stop?
And then, of course, in the next year, in that crash, fully $7 trillion was extracted from the American middle class in that bubble.
You know, Tom, it's interesting to note that what Ted Kennedy was talking about long before anybody was paying attention, he said there's many parts to what was happening to the economy then.
Yeah.
He said, we've talked about it before. He said this is really the beginning of what we call the scarcity enterprise. That is where jobs are scarce. Manufacturers are sending the jobs overseas. You have 20 people fighting for the same job in the United States. So that's the first thing that harms the economy and harms the job market. Then the second part of it was the overvaluation of a dollar. I mean, these were the parts that he and some other people were analyzing. The overvaluation of the dollar, as you know, I think you talked about in your book, affects GDP,
right?
I mean, it has a direct effect on the trade deficit. And it causes job loss because of that trade deficit. And then the third part is you have this reducing the GDP reduces job growth. But it all begins from that first thing, and that is to create job scarcity to where you can pay somebody $7 an hour, and they're willing to take the money because there's 20 people behind them that will take the money if they don't.
Right, and that nets out to either changing our trade policies or raising our minimum wage,
yes,
or going back to unionization, or
yes,
all three.
Yes. I think all three are required, and unfortunately, I don't know about you, but I'm not seeing anything. I'm seeing just the opposite. with discussions still on the table about TPP. And so you have to wonder, when are we going to change policy?
And these third-way Democrats, I don't know if you saw this thing. Marcos Melitzis just put this up over at the Daily Kos about the Democrats, calling out the Democrats by name. I will be doing it in the next segment.
Good.
Who are, and the third-way board of directors is almost entirely investment bankers, almost entirely. Mike Papantonio, ringoffireradio.com, Ring of Fire Radio on the weekends. Thank you, Pap.
Thank you, John.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Ringoffireradio.com is the website. And of course, you can hear the Ring of Fire, Mike Papantonio, Bobby Kennedy Jr., Sam Cedar, every week. This is, Pap, welcome back. This third way thing is just, Marcos has got his teeth into this thing.
I haven't seen it, Tom. I haven't seen it. I'm glad to hear you're going to report it. I understand it, the concept, but I haven't seen his report on it.
It's these guys, they ran an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal day before yesterday saying that if Elizabeth Warren was nominated for president, it would be the death of the Democratic Party. And that, you know, we need to cut Social Security and stuff. And so he lists the names of all the board of directors and writes their job descriptions next to them. And I'm telling you, 9/10 of them are investment bankers, literally.
Yeah.
Literally. It's amazing.
Well,
it's
unfortunate.
What's coming up on Ring of Fire Radio, Ring of Fire TV here on Free Speech TV this weekend?
We have David Pakman. He's going to tell us how corporations are using private companies to spy on activists and journalists and people who do exactly what you do for a living. Attorney Mike Berg is going to talk about Wall Street's wealth and how hoarding wealth is causing a domino effect where more people are going to prison because of the poor economy that creates. Linda Lipson's going to be here. She's from the American Association for Justice. She's going to talk about the FDA's proposal finally to enforce some rules against generic drug makers to where they can't kill people and never be held responsible. That's the notion of the law. That's where we are right now with the law. Tim O'Brien's going to tell us how the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is trying to dismantle the corruption laws that we have, making sure that corporations can't bribe public officials. U.S. Chamber of Commerce wants to do away with that. Howard Nations is going to talk about law schools and how the education is disgustingly poor in law schools nowadays.
Is that because of the Federalist Society?
It has a lot to do with it. It has to do with a guy named Posner put forth this idea that the only thing we need to be concerned about in the law is the economics of law. What is the impact on our economy? What does the action of law have to do with the economic output of this country?
As opposed to things like justice?
Yes. Justice and fairness and civil justice no longer. As a matter of fact, Posner, the guy I just described, is the most cited person. He's cited more times in law books than any other jurist. And the guy, he's a horrible character. I mean, in every respect, a horrible character. But he is the new greed is good kind of voice for law. Now they don't they don't teach him the idea of being socially responsible and doing some good things for this country. It is, how do we make our law work for big corporations?
That's amazing. And I don't see anything here about, promoting profits. We formed this country to make a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, promote the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterities. There's nothing in there about the economics.
Yeah, well,
that's the Constitution, the preamble.
It's morphed into our real purpose. It's the flag of one corporation that has the say on virtually everything we do. It's become a flag that represents corporate America in the truest sense. And that's what Howard's going to be talking about. That's the type of thing that's being discussed in law schools right now. And the caliber of law students that are being turned out are reflecting that type of teaching. They end up going to white shoe, silk stocking corporate law firms where they get paid a lot of money to do things like destroy documents and lie to consumers about what the corporation's done.
Well, I want to watch that. Ring of Fire Radio, Ring of Fire TV here on Free Speech TV. It's live Sundays at noon, but replayed every day of the week. And you can find it all over at ringoffireradio.com and, of course, at freespeech.org. Mike Papantonio, thanks so much for being with us, Pap.
Thank you, Tom.
Always an honor. Always great to see you. Hope you're well, buddy. So let's get geeky. Beef, it's not what you want for dinner. At least that's not what you're going to think after you hear about the latest secretive chemical that is in the food This isn't something they're talking about putting in our food. This is in the food we eat, at least if you eat pork or beef. I'm relieved to say that I have not done so since 1967. So I've never, apparently, they probably figured out something else that they can put it in. But anyhow, it's ractopine is a ractopamine is in 80% of the pork and beef in the United States and is even used in the Thanksgiving turkey you might have just eaten. It's popular in the meat and pork industry because it helps animals build muscle faster and more efficiently, and it helps companies cut costs on animal feed. But despite the growth additive, it's a drug that makes animals grow faster, despite it being in the meat we eat, the FDA has done very little research on just how dangerous ractopamine might be to humans. But the research that it has done is startling. The FDA found that ractopamine has caused more harm and health ailments to pigs than any other drug or additive ever. FDA research links ractopamine to a variety of health issues in pigs and cows, including bloat, hoof disorders, leg disorders, the inability to stand up, and yes, as they say on those commercials for all the drugs on TV, even death. A Canadian study looked at ractopamine's effects on monkeys and rats and found that the additive gave the monkeys a rapid heartbeat. The rats that were given ractopamine developed various birth defects, including shorter limbs, enlarged hearts, and missing digits. International studies on ractopamine's effects have prompted the European Union, Russia, China, Taiwan, and many other countries to ban it. In fact, ractopamine is considered such a danger in Taiwan that in 2007, thousands of Taiwanese pig farmers rioted after rumors spread that Taiwan's ban on the chemical is going to be lifted. Also in 2007, the Chinese government seized imports of U.S. meat after fears that it contained ractopamine. You get this? The Chinese think that our food is too contaminated for them? And just this year, after the U.S. government refused to adopt a ractopamine-free certification for its meat, Russia stopped all imports of American beef, pork, and turkey. Fortunately, independent organizations like the Center for Food Safety and the Animal Legal Defense Fund are working hard to alert the American public not only to the use of ractopamine, but its potentially harmful effects. Let's hope their efforts pay off and ractopamine is banned once and for all. But until that happens, you might want to stay away from the butcher shop. In fact, you might want to stay away from the butcher shop anyway, you know? Becoming a vegetarian, or even better, becoming a vegan, it's good for the diet, it's good for your diet, it's good for your health, it's good for the planet. It's a good thing. Another geeky science. I came across this today. I got to share it with you. You know what our universe is? Now, first of all, we've got our solar system. You know, that's the sun with the planets around it. That's our solar system. And our solar system is one of billions on the edge of what's called a galaxy, the Milky Way, which is this giant kind of spinning mass of stars and planets. And the Milky Way is one of billions of galaxies, each galaxy with billions of stars, and maybe trillions of galaxies in maybe more than that. I don't know. I'm not an astronomer, but I know the numbers are huge in the universe. And our universe apparently all began about 15 billion years ago with this single point. Maybe smaller than a period on the end of a sentence that just bang, popped out. And that bang continues, actually. Our universe is continuing to expand. Well, here's where it gets interesting. A few weeks ago, this is from spaceindustrynews.com. A few weeks ago, scientists published a new map of the cosmic microwave background. This is the radiation left behind by the Big Bang. 13.8, I said it was 15 billion years ago. I guess they've gotten much more exact. It's 13.8 billion years ago. Unless you're a Republican congressman. The map, based on Planck data, show anomalies in that background radiation that some experts say could only have been caused by the gravitational pull of other universes outside of our own. Just think about this for a minute. Our universe came into being apparently surrounded by other universes and pushed them out of the way as it got bigger and must be continuing to do so. Theoretical physicist Laura Herseny-Houghton at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill said these anomalies were caused by other universes pulling on our universe as it formed during the Big Bang. They are the first hard evidence of the existence of other universes that we have seen. This is quite remarkable. A lot of this came from radiation that's 3.7 billion years old when the universe was still glowing from the Big Bang. It had been traveling across space for 13.8 billion years to get to us because we're on the edge of the universe. We're way out here in the hinterlands. Now we've got evidence. They say it's George Astafiou, a professor of astrophysics at Cambridge, who co-authored the papers, said, you know, evidence now has changed the whole way we think about the universe. Wow. We're not just talking about life on other planets or other solar systems or other galaxies, but other universes? And I thought my problems were big. Right? We are so small in this giant thing. It is extraordinary. What a gift to be alive here in this universe.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And what a gift to be alive now in a time when we can learn these things. It's just extraordinary. The good, the bad, and the very, very poculiformly ugly, brought to you by the Organic Wine Company, EcoWine.com. The good, Kevin Leziga. When Elisa and Frank Constantini visited their local Rite Aid the day before Thanksgiving, they were startled to learn that Frank's pain medication would cost way more out of pocket than they expected. The couple, who are elderly Italian immigrants struggling to make ends meet, were distraught until pharmacist Kevin Leziga stepped in.
Leziga felt so bad for this elderly couple in dire need of medication, he attempted to foot the bill with a swipe of his credit card.
The transaction was over, but then she found that equal amount of money in her purse and just kind of left it on the counter.
The kind-hearted gesture from the soul of a stranger was enough to at least temporarily make Frank Costantini feel like $1 million.
Everything like a pain, everything was gone.
And help this family believe that good still exists.
Way to go, Kevin. The bad. The United States military. The ongoing Guantanamo Bay prison hunger strike has helped reinvigorate the debate surrounding closing the facility. That's likely the reason that the military announced on Wednesday that it will no longer make public the number of detainees on strike. According to the most recent report, that number stood at 15 on Monday, a four-person jump from November. According to the military, revealing the number of detainees on strike, quote, serves no operational purpose and detracts from the more important issues, which are the welfare of detainees and the safety and security of our troops. In other words, the military cares more about how the strike affects its PR campaign than it does about solving the underlying issues at stake. You know, if the military actually wanted to solve its Gitmo PR problem, it could start by doing one simple thing: close down the prison. Of course, that requires the cooperation of John Boehner. And the very, very ugly Congressman Duncan Hunter. The Republican congressman appeared on C-SPAN Wednesday to discuss American foreign policy in the Middle East. When asked about his thoughts on war with Iran, here is how he responded.
With American boots on the ground, would be a horrible thing. And I think people like to toss around the fact that we have to stop them in some way from gaining this nuclear capability. I don't think it's inevitable, but I think if you have to hit Iran, you don't put boots on the ground. You do it with tactical nuclear devices, and you set them back a decade or two or three. I think that's the way to do it with a massive aerial bombardment campaign.
That's right, nukem. And people wonder why the Iranians don't trust the United States. That is very, very ugly. That's mind-bogglingly ugly. Our universe could be one of billions. I mean, there are not just scientific implications to that. There are theological implications to that. There are, you know, psychological implications to that. There's just, it just goes on and on and on. And I see once again, it seems like every day we end up with a whole board full of calls. So let's just pick some up. Hey, David in Chicago.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Well, I'm unemployed. Other than that, I'm doing okay.
Oh,
and
sorry
I'm
to hear that.
Here to talk. Well, it's a crazy labor market, and when you talked about that young unemployed attorney working at
Macy's.
Men's clothing store,
yeah.
Macy's. It reminded me of Peter Vastag's story in the Washington Post last year, 2012, about all these PhDs and masters not being able to find work. And V-E-S-T-A-G, I believe, Peter Vastag. And I want to remind people that everybody's talking about immigration reform, but if this Senate bill and the House counterpart, H.R. 15, gets passed, 30 million new foreign legal workers will be allowed into the country in the next 10 years. And this speaks directly to Mr. Papantonio's idea of scarcity. And they want to do to this country what they did to Saipan, as reported by Thomas Frank's book, The Wrecking Crew, and just dump all this cheap foreign third world labor into our country and drive down wages. Yeah. And it just amazes me.
It's not just that they want to, David. They have been doing it for two decades.
Oh, yeah. Yes, especially since 86. And basically what happened in 86, you had the amnesty, and then in 1990, you had the H-1B law. And then you also had what I consider the delivery system of these visa programs, namely Section 1706 of the IRS code, extensively reported on by David K. Johnston several times in the 1990s and then again in 2010. So in other words, we have a delivery system based on a tax code that allows all these corporate intermediaries to separate workers from directly from employees through these body shops. And then you have these visa programs, which is basically a cancer on our labor market. And if we went back to Barbara Jordan's recommendation of 200,000 immigrants a year, we could manage this unemployment thing. But right now, 75,000 foreign legal workers every month allowed into our country. This is insane. The president knows this. And furthermore, he hired this Froman guy, U.S. Trade Representative, who was a former director at Citibank, another bankster, to handle trade policy. So these banksters and these monetizers have got us coming and going, and it's destroyed the labor market. It's created a very dysfunctional labor
market. I'm with you, David, and it's why we need to do more than just call into talk show hosts and complain. It's why we need to get involved with the outside game, groups like Progressive Democrats of America or Move to Amend or whatever it may be, you know, MoveOn.org, your favorite group. And we need to get on the inside game. We need to show up at the local Democratic Party and just start raising hell and volunteering to be the inside. But you're absolutely right. And I didn't mean to put you down. I'm not saying that all you're doing is calling in and complaining, but it's important that we have this conversation. It's important that we have this dialogue, and I appreciate every time you call up and raise it. And we need to take steps. We need to, you know, active steps, and you're doing a great job of waking people up to it. David, thank you for the call. Thanks for listening to WCPT. Neil in Wellington, Florida. Hey, Neil, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I've heard you and others talk about the increasing minimum wage and how that would, well, they could just take it out of executive pay and corporate profits. And I don't think it necessarily has to hit executive pay or profits at all, because if it applies to all of the industry, then it doesn't matter. You know, if Walmart, Kmart, Target that they all have to pay more. They all have to raise their prices, or they all can raise their prices. They all can continue making their profits. There's not necessarily any reason why it has to be taken out of anywhere. Sure, it's going to, you know, like the, the pizza company that is going to cost 17 cents more a pizza to provide health insurance for their employees.
So they claimed. It turned out they were lying.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so what if Domino's and Papa John's and everybody has to do the same thing? So everybody charges $15.17 for a pizza instead of $15 for a pizza.
Right.
It's like, so what? It's not going to impact their profits. They all raise their prices.
You know, Neil, I could debate you, but let me agree with you instead. Because I think everybody knows the points that I would make if I debated you, and I'm sure you could probably repeat them to me. But in agreeing with you, what I would say is that in the vast majority of products, and there are a few that are different, things like artisanal things, you know, handmade things, but the vast majority of products, labor is a small part of the overall costs. So if your labor costs are going up, say, 2% or 3% across your company, your product costs, you know, labor may represent 7-8% of your product cost. So your product cost is, you know, if your labor cost is going up 2%, labor is 7%, then your product cost is going to go up, what, 0.5%? And so if you decide to dump that on the consumers at that 0.5% increase in price, and so that $15 pizza becomes a $15 and 20 cent pizza, as a consumer and a wage earner, I would much rather go back to 30 years ago before Reaganomics, where it cost me a little more for a pizza, or probably a more practical example would be it cost me more to buy underwear or to buy a shirt because they were made in the United States. It cost me more to buy clothing, but I made more. I would much rather pay a little bit more for my products and have a living wage than have a crap wage. And I've been struggling for ever since that guy called the other day and said last hour and said we should call it no wage but you know, what do you call it? You probably shouldn't call it that either. You shouldn't say that on the radio, but whatever. A lousy wage, rather than have a lousy wage and low prices because, you know, you got slaves in Bangladesh willing to make your stuff. Am I making sense?
Absolutely. I'm that's exactly my point is if Walmart had to pay $15 an hour, so does Target. So does
right.
Safeway. So does Sears. Everybody has to
right.
pay
so
it.
The price.
Everybody raised their prices a little bit. All their employees would be better off. All their employees would have more money to spend. The economy would do better.
And this would not be inflationary in the genuine sense of inflationary, because it would not mean a debasement of our currency, even though prices and wages have slightly gone up.
Right. Yeah.
So, yeah. Neil, thank you for the call. Thank you. Usually when people are making the point that you make, they're trying to debate me, and I had a sense that you weren't. You were making, that's a very smart point, and it needs to be made more often. We'll be right back. It's 15 minutes before that.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And we'll be back with more of the news of the day, my thoughts, your thoughts, and all that kind of stuff. Right after this. And welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And let's pick up some Free Speech TV calls. Pam in Long Beach, California, watching Free Speech TV on the web at freespeech.org. Hey, Pam, what's up?
I had a question about Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
My mother-in-law and father-in-law both worked for the government.
Mm-hmm.
And now this was a few years ago,
mm-hmm.
But they did not get Social Security. They only got their government pension.
Right.
Now, I know the federal government, which my father-in-law worked for, has now changed so that those employees pay into Social Security too.
Right.
But my mother-in-law was a school teacher and they didn't pay Social Security and they didn't get Social Security.
Right.
Do you know if Detroit people are in that same predicament? Because if so, and if they lose their pension, they have nothing.
Yeah, yeah. I honestly don't know the answer to that, Pam. I'm guessing that if even a large fraction of them were in that position, that Reverend Bullock would have talked about that yesterday, and there would be a lot of sturm and drang about it. So I'm guessing that that's not the case, that probably Michigan or Detroit was not one of the cities that did that opt-out. I think a lot of that went on in the South. But I honestly don't know the answer. Shane is furiously Googling right now, so we may have the answer shortly for you, and if we do, I'll report it back to you, okay?
Okay, well, my mother-in-law and father-in-law were in California, and California teachers did not pay into the Social Security.
Yeah.
And at that point in time, the federal government didn't either.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you very much, Pam. I appreciate the call. Mary in Little Mountain, South Carolina. Hey, Mary. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV on Dish Network. What's up?
Yes, I heard you make the comments about that you probably wouldn't invest your money in the United States stock market, but you would in Germany.
Yeah.
My husband works as a Teamster for UPS here in South Carolina. He was talking about wanting to buy stock in UPS. So you're saying that's probably not a good idea?
I don't know. I am not an investment advisor, and I have, in my lifetime probably lost more money than I've made in investments in the stock market and things. So don't take my advice on anything. What I do know, independent of investment, is that in America, in this country, our fundamentals are all screwed up. Our workers are poorly paid. Our billionaires are skimming money off the top. Our banking, virtually every sector is dominated by a small handful of companies. Whereas in Germany, they have a law that requires any company that has over 1,000 employees, the board of directors has to be 50% made up of union representatives. Virtually everybody's unionized in Germany. There's lots of small companies. There's lots of industry in Germany that's very solid and very stable. Germany is an industrial powerhouse. So it was kind of an offhand remark, although I did actually read it as an advice in an investment newsletter a couple of weeks ago. It was in the Aiden forecast, as I recall, and which I take seriously. But I, like I said, I'm not one of those rich guys who's moving, millions around, so I don't, But I'm very concerned that the U.S. stock market is in a bubble, that it's going to continue to grow for a certain period of time. And whether that's 6 months, a year, 2 years, or 3 years, it can't be, in my opinion, more than 3 years. Or whether it's even just 2 weeks, that bubble's going to burst. And when that bubble bursts, we're going to see our stock market back down around 5,000 or 6,000 again. And people are going to get wiped out. The banksters won't get wiped out, but the people will. And I don't think that it's going to hit the Europeans as bad. Mary, thank you for the call. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And sad news. Nelson Mandela, well, he was 95 years old. In a way, it's not sad news. It's kind of respectful, dignified news. At the age of 95, Nelson Mandela has passed into the light. Into the, what we used to think was just one universe, the many universes, the multiverse. Wow, can you imagine if he's connected to all that stuff right now? There have been times in my life, on airplanes that I thought were going to crash or whatever, where I was afraid for my life. But more and more, the more I see people die, the more I actually see, with people, or like my cat a couple of weeks ago died. And the less afraid of it I am, and the more I am just awed by everything that I don't know and I don't understand and what is so beyond, Nelson Mandela. I'm not one of those people who believes in heaven with harps and angels and or hell with pitchforks, and I don't think there's some old guy who organizes all that. Even though I call myself a Christian. I think my perspectives and philosophies are consistent with those of what Christ taught. But and his predecessors. Let's not forget Jesus was a Jew. Jewish teaching, real Muslim teaching. Hindu, Buddhist. But in any case, Nelson Mandela has passed on. And his memory is going to last a long, long time. This is a man who changed a lot of people's lives. And he did it by being willing to stand up, first of all, by being willing to die, speaking of death, by being willing to go to prison, and by going to prison for what turned out to be about a third of his life, 27 years. It's amazing. You know who, in my mind, they're not the Nelson Mandelas of the day because, I mean, he's just like really bigger than life. But, right now, the Republicans in Congress are refusing to close Guantanamo. And we have 14, 15 people down there on a hunger strike. And we're stop reporting the numbers. You know, I riffed about this in the good, the bad, and ugly. Enough said, I guess. Joe in Chino, California. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Hey, it seems to me like the burden of this public assistance is being held by the middle class.
Mm-hmm.
At some point, there's not going to be middle class left. And remember that Teddy Roosevelt thing you play a lot is about a living wage, the one that makes morality possible.
Right.
So I think in the answer to Teddy Kennedy's question, where does the greed end? And my wife will tell you I'm a cynic and I really want to be wrong about this, but I think it ends with the guillotine.
See, or revolution.
Yeah, and I think I think the revolution is going to come within the ranks of the military.
Yeah. Okay. You're a lot more pessimistic than I am. I view what happened in 1932 as a revolution. I view what happened in 1800 as a revolution. Dan Sisson is one of America's greatest historians, and he wrote a brilliant book called The Revolution of 1800 about the election of Thomas Jefferson, which transformed America. The election of 1932, I believe, was a revolution. The election of 1860, I believe, was a revolution. I really believe that the election of 2016 is going to be a revolutionary election. We shall see. But I think that a revolution is coming, but I don't think it's going to involve guillotines or guns or the military, frankly. I think it's going to involve voters. You know, so
and I want to be wrong.
Yeah, I hope you're wrong, Joe. I know there's a lot of people who think the way you do, and there's a lot of them who think that way on the right, and they're storing up food and buying it from Glenn Beck's buddies, and they're storing guns and ammunition, and I just don't think that's the way to go either. I'm guessing that's not your shtick, but Thanks a lot for the call, Marcia, in Angier, North Carolina. Hey, Marcia.
Hi, Tom. I have to call about yesterday. You had a pastor or a religious person on. I remember part of his website, CAC. Mm-hmm. Do you remember him?
Oh, Reverend Bullock. Yeah, actioncac.org.
Oh,
change,
I want to
change.
Punch a hole.
Yeah, actioncac.org.
I want to punch a hole through something. He made me so upset. But very quickly...
you're mixing two people up. You're talking about the right winger that I had on before him who said Jesus was a capitalist. Okay?
Yeah, okay. That's him.
Yeah,
that's
the right winger who said Jesus was a capitalist. And it occurred to me later that Jesus couldn't have been a capitalist because he didn't live off capital. He was a tradesman.
But look, I'm willing to concede he's a carpenter. There was some trade and bartering going on, but I doubt he was charging people three times what the value of what his work was. But I need to make you an honorary African-American right now because you missed something, and I want you to have your antenna up and not miss it again.
Okay.
And that is that he said that capitalism, that paying taxes, somebody would call me now. He said that paying taxes capitalism a crime.
Okay.
And that capitalism was not. And I'm saying, be out of his freaking mind. How come I can't?
Yeah, I get it. No, I'm with you. I think he said actually collecting taxes was the crime, not paying them, because, you know, government involves force. It's the old libertarian argument, and he's wrong. And capitalism is what's gutted this country. Raw, unrestrained, you know, Reagan let the capitalists loose. And they've been deregulated over and over and over again. And what it's done is it's devastated not just communities of color, although it's especially devastated communities of color, but it's also devastated, yeah, pretty much everybody in the, not just the United States, but all over the world, except for the very rich. Marcia, thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And where did my one sheet go? My desk is such a mess here. I can't. That's why we've got this little wall here to cover it up. Tony Katz is on the line with us, conservative commentator, host of Tony Katz Tonight in the Radio, contributor to townhall.com. Tony Katz, KATZ.com is his website. Hey, Tony, welcome back to the program.
It's a pleasure to be with you. It's good to be back. It's been a while.
So today is Fast Food Thursday. We've got all these fast food workers all across the country saying, you know, roughly half of us are trying to raise a family out here, and you can't do that on $9 an hour, and we would like to make, you know, at least 10 or 11, maybe. 15 would be nice, but we'd settle for 10 or 11. And you're saying these people are thugs?
No. I in no way am I saying that the employees are thugs. I've never actually said that in
my
life.
I thought your headline was Fast Food Thursday because big labor bullies need a beatdown.
Yes, it's big labor. That's the key problem, and that's
bullies.
The subject. The subject is not the workers. There are a lot of people working in fast food for a lot of reasons. Some of them are getting the skills that they need to get better jobs. That'll be better paying jobs.
Oh, yeah.
Some of them,
we really need to know how to fry French fries to get a better job.
No. It's about showing up on time. It's about how you deal with the public. There are a lot of things that are learned in these industries. Let's not
discount these people. By 28-year-olds?
Tom, let's not.
The average age of a fast food worker in America, Tony, is 28.
Tom.
Of course I'm not.
Tom. Wait, you want to let's talk about then the third group of employees, which are those who are victims of the Obama economy. That's just fact, and I'm glad you're bringing it up. Thank you.
32 years of Reaganomics has ripped the guts out of this country.
Oh,
I'm with you, Tony.
It. That's an unfair
32
thing to
years
say.
of Reaganomics.
You're pivoting, and I need you to focus on the subject. Big labor is putting together these strikes based on the myth of the living wage in order to get union dues. This is about big labor getting money, SEIU and AFSCME and others getting money. This isn't about caring about the worker. I can't believe.
Okay,
let's
assume, Tony, for a moment. Tony, let's assume you're right.
Okay.
Let's assume you're right. Let's just stipulate, for the purposes of this conversation, for at least the next 3 or 4 minutes, that Tony is right. That SEIU and AFSCME and the whatever unions are involved, and I have no idea which ones they are, who they are, or whatever. That they want to get members, and they want to get members because members pay dues.
Right.
Who are the stockholders in those unions? Now, I realize, you know, when Mitt Romney takes over a company, he gets to put $1 billion in his back pocket. But I thought labor unions were nonprofit, democratic, small d, democratic institutions. They were democracies. They were run by their members. that the way the money is spent, every last penny of the way that the money is spent in a union has to be agreed upon by more than 51% of the members, and that if anybody disagrees with this, any expenditure used for political purposes, the union has to refund that money to them. This is federal law. I don't understand why it's a bad thing that a democratic institution is in the workplace, particularly under these circumstances.
I would say to you, and maybe in two parts, maybe in more, and I think it's a very interesting comeback that you come with right there, especially the agreeing with me part, even though it's only going to be for a short window, that you talk about where this money goes, that they raise this money, and it goes specifically to candidates who then benefit a big labor position.
But if there are any workers in the union,
right,
who do not want money, their union dues, to go to a political candidate, and they don't actually go to candidates, you know, they go to advocacy things.
I'm curious to see how many of those are actually instituted.
It happens all the time.
Actually,
it happens all the time. It's a major problem for unions.
Well, I'm always happy for a major problem for a union that doesn't actually treat people properly. I have no issue actually with unionizing. I do have an issue with the idea of trying to shame people into unionizing and using the myth of the living wage to do it. I mean, this whole idea that $15 an hour, I was stunned to hear you say $10 or $11 an hour, because that's you not holding on to the party line in this case. But why 15? Why not 20? Why not 50? Why not 100?
Because 20, 50, or 100 doesn't make any sense.
Okay. 15. Let me just give you
a couple of numbers here, Tony.
No. Say those others don't make sense, and 15 doesn't make sense. Only the market makes sense. Thank you for proving a point.
The market makes sense if there was a market. But what we have is a rigged economy. It is an absolutely rigged economy.
No, I'm not going to disagree that we've got problems with the economy. I'm not going
to
disagree
with
that.
If we were to change our trade policies, if we were to repudiate the policies of Bill Clinton, which would make you happy, and the policies of Ronald Reagan, which would make me happy with regard to free trade, we would not have lost 50,000 factories since 2000, and probably 100,000 factories or more since Reagan's presidency, if we were to repudiate that. If we were to go back to some sort of rational, you know, trade policies. If we were to go back to saying, you know, after you're welcome to make $1 million a year, $2 million a year, $3 million a year, but after that $3 million a year, you're going to have to pay 74% income tax. In other words, if we roll back the Reagan tax cuts so that instead of CEOs making 30 times what their workers make,
$3 million instead of 30,000, the CEOs would say,
I think I'll put that money back
herrings.
In the company. These are not red herrings. These are the core.
Herrings.
No, this is the guts of an economy, Tony. You know this.
No, it's not. It's not acceptable to say that there's a cap. It's not acceptable to say that there's a limit.
I'm not saying there's a limit. There were people who were willing to pay 74% income tax.
No one should have to pay 74% income tax to their silent partner, the U.S. government. Nonsense.
How do you think they make that $3 million?
I'm sorry, I don't understand your question.
Somebody who's making more than $3 million a year.
Right.
Okay. Are they not making that because all of the rest of us have provided them with consumers who actually know how to read the packaging of their product, with an educated labor force, with a court system that they can use to enforce their contracts with their suppliers and their buyers and their customers, with a telecommunications infrastructure that they can use to make sure that they get their products the way that they need to, with a physical infrastructure that they can get their products to market? We are paying for all that. The more money they're making, the more they are using that infrastructure. In fact, more than 70% of our court system is used exclusively by business, but business only pays 11% of the total federal tax load in the United States. We, you and me, working stiffs, are paying for the court system that Mitt Romney is using to enforce his corporate scams.
I'm simply saying
the people, after they start making about $3 million a year, and the history shows this, because this is what it was from 1935 until 1986. When they're making over $3 million a year, they're using more of the commons. They should pay more.
Your argument presupposes that the people don't get any benefit, which I reject wholeheartedly. And secondly,
benefit from what? They don't get any benefit from somebody making $7 million a year instead of $3 million a year?
You don't think that the people get benefit from others doing well? Or
I do not think
the
people get benefit from Mitt Romney having another $1 billion to put in a Swiss bank account. No, I don't.
I'm sorry. You keep going to Mitt Romney, but there are a lot of leftists out there with much more money than Mitt Romney.
I don't think the people benefit from George Soros having another $1 billion to put in a Swiss bank.
Beyonce on your list? Kanye on your list? I mean, I'm just curious. Who's on your list? Susan Sarandon on your list?
I have sat in a room with George Soros, and I can tell you, he doesn't think that people benefit from him having another $1 billion to put in a Swiss bank, although he's perfectly willing to make it. But the fact of the matter is, he will tell you to your face, he would like to pay that 74% income tax.
He should.
He thinks he should.
He should write the check.
And so should Mitt Romney.
I reject that you can force people to do it, but I got to go back to this 3 million figure. I think it's fascinating. You're trying to give some kind of historical record to it. Why not 2 million? Isn't 2 million enough?
Well, at various times, if you look at the value of the dollar, it's wandered around between roughly, the CEO to average worker pay in the 1960s and the 1970s, prior to the Reagan administration, the average worker was making around $30,000 a year. The average CEO was making around $300,000. That was 30 to 1. Actually, that's 10 to 1.
I've been on the program this entire segment. I'm not quite sure what you said.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll have to do it again then.
We definitely will.
Tony Katz, TonyKatz.com is the website. Host of the Tony Katz Tonight program, contributor to townhall.com. Tony, thanks for dropping by.
Good to be with you.
Always good talking with you. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman program.
Somebody's got to talk back to him. Somebody's got to. Where's my Valium? Welcome back. I should say, where's my glass of organic wine? We did a funny for the free for the RT Christmas party today, and it was a takeoff on the most interesting man in the world ad. And at the very end, I'm pouring myself a glass of Russian vodka. I should have brought it with me. Oh my. Anyway, Carl in Nashville, Tennessee. Hey, Carl, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up? Excuse me.
Well, thank you for having me. I don't know. I think Ronald Reagan basically was probably the worst president that I've seen in my lifetime. I know for sure.
I agree.
I do. And I can never.
Although George W. Bush gives him a hell of a run for his money.
Well, George W. Bush hasn't done generational damage to our economy like Ronald Reagan did.
But he has done generational economy to probably 6 or 7 million people, about a million of them in the United States and about 5 or 6 million of them in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Correct. But
I get your point. I get your point.
To me, the minimum wage.
Yeah.
I think the Senate needs to take a page. The Democrats in the Senate need to take a page from the House of Representatives, the Republicans in the House. I think they need to come back with a $12, and if they filibuster, come back with $14, and just keep on. I mean, all the way up to $20 an hour, and just make them keep filibustering to show the American public who's on their side.
Yep.
I started working for myself years ago, and one of the things that pushed me over the edge, and I need to write a book called The Potato, The Bag of Potatoes. That's going to be the name of my entrepreneurial story. You may say, well, what the hell does that have to do with anything? Well, I remember when I worked for a restaurant. The last job I had, I worked for a restaurant. They had these gigantic bag of potatoes that probably cost about $10 to the company, but they were charging like $6 or $7 for a loaded baked potato.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, wow, someone is making a lot of money, because you're paying $10 for over a 100-pound bag of potatoes, and you're charging $6 for a loaded baked potato. Someone's making a lot of money.
Yeah.
Someone's making a lot of money in this country, and it's not the average worker. You cannot survive off of $10 an hour in this country. Do the math. Four times 40 hours a week is just not possible. So they need to make these guys filibuster time and time again. But you know they won't, because they're spineless.
Yeah. You know, I agree. Carl, you called up earlier, what was it, last week or the week before, and made a similar suggestion. And, keep reminding me of it until I start repeating it, would you?
Absolutely. And I have to, because I think that this is something that I don't even think they even thought about this before. But I guess the Democratic mind don't think of things like this.
No, they're too busy being reasonable.
If Republicans were the opposition, they would do this. Exactly.
Sure. Yeah. Exactly. They, you know, the Democrats are sitting around going, what's possible? What can we do that's reasonable? And the Republicans are going, how can we screw these guys up and get what we want?
Exactly. And I guess it's the Chicago Democrat in me that think, how can I screw these guys?
There you go. There you go, Carl. God bless you. Keep reminding me until you hear me start repeating it on the radio, because I you know, I'm learning a lesson from you. That's a really, really smart one. Thank you, Carl. Thank you. That's a very smart idea. We will be back. It is 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you, 20 minutes past the hour. As I mentioned at the end of the last hour, when the news first broke, Nelson Mandela has passed away. I started out by saying it was sad news, you know, that the world had lost this great man. But he was 95, I believe. And that's a good life. That's a good life. So it's more... It's actually kind of Mandela-ish or esque. It's dignified news. A very dignified man who is willing to lay his life on the line for a principle, for his people, but for his nation and for a principle. And who ultimately, you know, he was willing to die and nearly did on more than one occasion, was willing to go to prison and spent 27 years there, 27 years in prison. And saw his nation changed in part, not totally, of course. I mean, you know, I think we all need to be careful of this deification syndrome. Martin Luther King would be the first to tell you that it was the people with him that helped make him. Rosa Parks used to, until she recently died, I mean, she used to talk a lot about how she didn't just one day decide to sit in the front of that bus. She had been through years and years of trainings and participating in the movement, and well, I can't tell the story as well as she can and others, but the point is that Nelson Mandela has passed. He was a great man. I'm not a believer in the great man theory of history. But I do believe that moments make great men and women. And he was one of them. And so, and in keeping with our geeky science earlier, where it turns out the latest research, it looks like our universe actually, when it popped into existence 13.8 billion years ago, it kind of fit in between a bunch of other universes, and it's been continuously expanding and bumping up against them, and it isn't that amazing. I have a feeling Nelson Mandela right now understands that. And someday I will, and someday you will too. And I think that's kind of cool. So I mourn his loss. I really, after my father and mother both died, I learned to come to terms. It's not easy. You know, I fell apart crying on the air 2 weeks ago when my cat died. It's not easy to come to terms with the death of another. But I think, several of my best friends have died just in the last few months. But I think that it is something we are all going to experience, every one of us. And we need to be celebrating the life of Nelson Mandela rather than mourning the death. I guess that's it in a nutshell. Don, in Salt Lake City, Utah. Hey, Don, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. I appreciate being on your program.
Thanks for calling.
I'm just sorry to hear about your cat. I haven't had a chance to talk to you or to listen to you forever. And sorry to hear about Higgins, right?
Yeah, it was Higgins. Higgins passed away. Yeah. That's the bad news. The good news, I guess, is that Louise got a new cat today.
Well, congratulations.
Wolfie, new family member.
Yeah. And I loved your tribute to Nelson Mandela, too.
Thank you.
I have good libertarian friends,
And I can't seem to sort through this Fed argument they always have. I'm sure it's basically coming from Ron Paul.
Yeah.
Can you give me as one of the smartest men in the room, I always tell people when I talk about you, give me the synopsis of that, please.
The argument is that, well, actually, the argument takes a lot of different forms, and in some ways it's kind of an incoherent argument. One form of the argument is that the Fed is basically the ultimate banking conspiracy, to control the currency of the money, and it's the banksters and the bad guys, and sometimes they fit that into the whole, international banker conspiracy, and then the real crazies put that into the international Jewish banker conspiracy and all that other kind of, anti-Semitic nonsense. So there's that part of it, and there certainly was a large anti-Semitic contingent to the early Ron Paul days and the libertarian movement. So that number one. Number two, there's the creature from Jekyll Island. Oh, is the president coming on? The president's speaking about Nelson Mandela. Let's cut to this. Hold
on. In 1964, Nelson Mandela closed a statement from the dock saying, I have fought against white domination, and I have fought against black domination. I have cherished the ideal of a democratic and free society in which all persons live together in harmony and with equal opportunities. It is an ideal which I hope to live for and to achieve. But if needs be, it is an ideal for which I am prepared to die. And Nelson Mandela lived for that ideal, and he made it real. He achieved more than could be expected of any man. And today he's gone home. And we've lost one of the most influential, courageous, and profoundly good human beings that any of us will share time with on this earth. He no longer belongs to us. He belongs to the ages. Through his fierce dignity and unbending will to sacrifice his own freedom for the freedom of others, Madiba transformed South Africa and moved all of us. His journey from a prisoner to a president embodied the promise that human beings and countries can change for the better. His commitment to transfer power and reconcile with those who jailed him set an example that all humanity should aspire to.
And I think that was probably the most important example, the reconciliation, the Truth and Reconciliation Commissions. What an extraordinary thing. What an extraordinary thing that Nelson Mandela helped bring about. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And when we come back, I'm going to try and finish answering Don's thing about the Fed, and then we've got some people who want to talk about Mandela and Jesus wasn't a capitalist in the solar system and all kinds of stuff. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you 28 minutes before the hour. And Don in Salt Lake City, Utah, I was trying to explain to you libertarians and the Fed. And maybe some libertarians will call in and share with us their additional theories. There has been an argument in this country since the founding of the Republic about whether we should have a national bank. The Constitution authorizes Congress to coin money and to determine the value of it. And the Treasury Department does that. In fact, all of our coins are not Federal Reserve notes. They are actual money minted by the United States, and they are the only money that is owned by the United States, and, that's real money. The stuff that comes out of the Fed, these Federal Reserve notes, are basically IOUs, and it's a form of fiat currency. It's money that circulates that represents a promise by the United States via the Fed through this agreement that was made. And there's a book called the Monster from Jekyll Island or something like that, The Creature from Jekyll Island, I think, that talks about the creation, not so much of the Fed, but really of the modern monetary system in the 1940s. And all of this kind of gets thrown together in this mishmash of conspiracy theories and whatnot. I personally think that the Fed is a good idea. I think that having a central bank is a good idea. However, That said, I don't think it should be independent of the government. I think it should be federalized. The Fed is owned by, although the chairman of the Fed is, and half the members of the Fed are appointed by the administration, or some percentage of the members are appointed by the administration. The Fed is actually owned by the 12 regional banks, and they are owned by their local banks. So when I lived in, and I learned this personally, because when I lived in Montpelier, Vermont, I was banking with Chittenden Bank, and the bank manager and I were having a conversation one day. It was a little tiny bank in a little tiny town, and he said, we're doing a stock offering if you'd like to buy stock in the bank, and you will actually own stock in the Fed, because our bank is in part owned by the First National Bank of Boston, and is owned by, or they own, I forget which direction the ownership would go. And the First National Bank of Boston is one of the 12 banks that owns the Fed. So, you know, you would be owning a little piece of the Fed if you bought stock in our bank. I didn't. I said on the air I'm not much of an investor. Probably should have. I don't know, but whatever. But that's the deal. And the Fed has served, and the reason I think the Fed is a good thing is that it has served as a stabilizer for example, this quantitative easing that's going on right now. The reason I think that it can be a bad thing is that if you get bad Fed policy, as we had under Alan Greenspan, with artificially low interest rates, then you get bubbles and you get a bad economy. And the Fed has two mandates by law. One is to keep inflation low, and the other is to keep unemployment low. And since Alan Greenspan came into office, that keep unemployment low part has been ignored. You'll remember that inflation was up around 16-17% during the Carter administration, when Paul Volcker was running the Fed. In the election of 1980, when Jimmy Carter went up against Ronald Reagan, the unemployment rate was only 3.6%. So the Fed was actually working to keep unemployment low as they were trying to wring inflation out of the economy, which was that inflation being largely the result of both the Vietnam War and the Arab oil embargo. So I think that, you know, the idea of the Fed is a good one. I think it needs to be more responsive to the people, and I think it needs to be federalized. I think it should be part of the Treasury Department. Making sense?
Perfect. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Don. And you know, if any libertarians who are just hysterical about the Fed want to call in and share with us their thoughts on, you know, why they're so opposed to it. I think it needs to be audited, too. There's no transparency in the Fed. Bernie Sanders finally got it audited for a year, and we discovered that the Fed was loaning money willy-nilly to rich people, to billionaires, during the crash. Why are they doing that? That's not a good that's not a good reason. Gary in Los Angeles, listening on KPFK. Hey, Gary, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking this call. Let me get off speaker.
Thank you.
We can talk better. I called yesterday, actually, in response to your conversation with the Tea Party guy that was claiming that Jesus was a capitalist because he was a carpenter.
Right.
And you guys had an interesting conversation, interesting beyond after he was off the air, too. It surprised me, though, that you didn't bring up the formation of the original church on the day of Pentecost in Acts. Look at chapter 5, right at the end of chapter 5, into chapter 4, going into chapter 5. I'll just read some highlights here if I can have a quick moment.
Why don't you just summarize it for us, please, rather than reading? We have a kind of no-reading rule here on the show. So you can just tell us what
happened. Well, the thing is, they formed a commune. They brought all of their
They shared their possessions
together.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
they became communists.
They had all things in common. And actually the wording is very, very close to from all according to his ability, to all according to his need.
Well, you can go back to the Last Supper, by the way, and, you know, when Jesus turned to Judas and said, you know, go out and pay for, somebody had to pay for something, and there's a phrase about, and the common purse in the Last Supper place. So, pardon my interrupting you, Gary.
Right.
So, yeah.
No, that's okay. In fact, I have the thoughts that Marx may well have been inspired by the passage in the book of Acts, and I seem to recall years ago
doing a little bit of research and finding some scholars that agreed with that idea. Also, if you look at the Sermon on the Mount, you know, Jesus said, don't lay up your treasure on earth, but in heaven, because you can't serve two masters. You can't serve God and money.
Yeah. I think, though, that an even more cogent, if we want to be intellectually honest about all this, argument, which I totally forgot to make yesterday. I totally failed to make it. One of the people in the chat room reminded me of it, and I didn't read it until after I got off the air. I thought I wish I'd caught it during the time. Is that a capitalist is a person who lives on capital. Mitt Romney's a capitalist. Paris Hilton's a capitalist. A capitalist is somebody who invests their money and then sits on their butt around the pool waiting for the dividend checks to arrive. And Jesus, even if he was a carpenter, was not a capitalist. He was a tradesman. He was a worker. He wasn't a capitalist. Yes.
I was actually going to bring that up, too. That was quite a logical leap to say that because Jesus was a carpenter, therefore he was a small businessman, therefore he was a capitalist. You can be a carpenter without being a businessman or a capitalist.
Right, and most small businessmen are not capitalists, by the way.
Yes, right.
Because they're not living off their equity, they're living off their work. They're self-employed workers. You know, I can tell you. I can tell you. So thank you, Gary. Thank you. It's excellent point. Doug, in Port Townsend, Washington, you wanted to talk about Nelson Mandela.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Thanks. The problem with being on hold with you is so many doors are open. I almost forget the original point I wanted to make, but I was recalling an event in Oakland that Mandela was at about, I think it was about 20 years ago, maybe 21 years ago. And he was there, and he came to the Bay Area, to Oakland specifically, because he wanted to make a speech to students and faculty and people at the University of California, and wanted to make sure they were there because they did play a role in what happened in South Africa by being one of the leaders in divestment in investment in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it occurred to me, of course, Mandela Man, that Ronald Reagan, who's invoked so many times on your show, called a terrorist, which, you know, just boggles the
mind. Yeah, and we should never forget that Ronald Reagan referred to Mandela repeatedly as a terrorist.
Quite often, because he was against the divestment movement and boycotting of South Africa, which I know you're against boycotts, but it certainly worked in that case.
Yeah.
And you know, the Reagan called him a terrorist while the Contras were freedom fighters. But I just wonder, in today's political and economic climate, you know, if the University of California system, which is, you know, equal to the, you know, the economies of several small countries, you know, would even consider divesting their financial interests in a country because of the practices that were going on there. And, you know, when you look at
an industry, like the fossil fuel industry.
Exactly. You know, and Janet Napolitano, who played such a key role in expanding the tentacles of Homeland Security into the university systems through research grants and dollars and partnerships, and who, you know, gets a $10,000 a month house rented for her as the new president of UC Regents, while they're doing a $3.5 million remodel on the home she's going to live in. And, you know, I'm not suggesting that she's paid too much based on the financial resources of the UC system, which is publicly funded by California taxpayers and is constantly having to raise tuitions because costs are going up, and, you know, it's the whole nine yards. But the key is Mandela making that speech to thank UC, which I doubt today. I you know, just curious as to what your opinion would be if they would even consider such a move.
I don't recall Mandela making a speech thanking UC. When and where did that happen?
That was at the Oakland Coliseum in 1992. He specifically thanked the University of California students for creating the uproar that caused the university system and the regents to it was when he was on that tour that he did the States, and it was either 92 or 93. But he specifically made note of UC and its students.
Amazing. Doug, thank you for sharing that with us. How things have changed, huh? Thanks a lot, Doug. I appreciate the call. We will be back. It's 15 minutes past the hour. Or before the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Nelson Mandela has passed away. Minutes before the hour, welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. Wayne in Chicago. Hey, Wayne, you had some thoughts on Nelson Mandela.
Yes, how you doing this afternoon, Tom?
I am very well, Wayne, and I would be very interested to know your thoughts on this great man.
Yes, I just wanted to give a shout-out to Nelson Mandela, being one of the greatest human beings in the history of the planet, and also to my mom for being one of the greatest human beings in the history of the planet. My mom passed away 5 years ago today.
Hmm.
So even though I'm very, very sad about Nelson Mandela, extremely sad, I'm happy because now my mom gets to kick it with Nelson Mandela.
There you go. There you go.
What I wanted to say was, he's a human being who was known by the whole world. My mom is unknown by the whole world. But both of those people have the same heart. You follow what I'm saying?
I do.
Same type of heart. Good-hearted, decent-hearted people.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all I wanted to say.
Well, thank you, Wayne. And I appreciate the call and I'm guessing there's going to be a lot of tributes to Nelson Mandela over the next 24 hours. That was one of the more eloquent ones. Thank you. Thank you, Wayne. David, in Germantown, Tennessee, you wanted to go back to our debate from an hour ago about today, all across the nation, fast food workers are basically going out on strike saying we would like a minimum wage of $15.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I've been on hold for 30 minutes, but I just had a question for you. I know that you're a business owner. Are you still a business owner?
This radio show is a business that I own, yes.
Okay. Your prior businesses, though, do you still own those?
No, I don't.
Okay. You sold them? Or?
Yes. One died painful death. we sold to our employees, and one of them still survives. And a couple of others we sold to other people. Yeah. Why?
Okay. I just really wanted to get your opinion on if you thought that the raising the minimum wage would actually hurt this lower class because the competition for the jobs would increase and all these young people being out of work that are a little more educated and a little bit more well-spoken.
Well, that's the argument that's been made since 1935 when the minimum wage was first put into place, but it has never, ever been demonstrated to be true. I mean, if it had ever, and literally it's been since 1935, if it had ever been demonstrated to be true, instead of calling me and asking me the question the way you just did, you would instead be calling and saying, you know, when Portland, Oregon decided to raise the minimum wage a buck and a half above the federal minimum wage, suddenly there was, over the next 2 years, a 4% decline in employment among people who were under 20 years old. Now, how do you respond to that, Hartman? But see, you can't say that because there is no such example. This is what's called a canard. It's a straw man. It's a phony argument. It doesn't happen.
Well, in this particular situation, I think it's unique because of the amount of unemployment and because it's not just raising the minimum wage a dollar. It's attempting to double the minimum wage. And if I own a small business also, so if I'm doubling my minimum wage, the first thing I'm thinking of is more attractive employees that I'm going to be looking for. I don't know if that's the way you feel about it, but a minimum wage double is quite a bit different than a dollar raise.
I don't think that $15 an hour is going to cause somebody to go from I'm looking for somebody who's a high school graduate to somebody I'm looking for somebody who's got a PhD.
I don't mean them looking for. I mean the competition. Like, I'm a 25-year-old. I'm not, but let's say I'm a 25-year-old guy with a college degree, well-spoken, super smart, can't find a job. All of a sudden, this minimum wage goes up to $15. Hey, it's not so bad working at McDonald's now. So I'm going to go take that job from a lower.
No, $15 an hour still sucks, David.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Hey, I agree with you, but I was just getting your opinion if you thought a double. And the minimum wage is maybe a little excessive
If the minimum wage right now was where it was in 1968, it would be $10.20 an hour. If the minimum wage, if the minimum wage had gone up at the same percentage that the increase in wages, not wealth, but because wealth is much, much greater than this, but just wages, at the same rate that the increase of wages of the top 10% of Americans has gone up since 1980, the minimum wage right now would be $22 an hour. So why is it okay for the top 1%, and it's not causing any weird dislocations in that marketplace, or the top 10%, but it's not okay for everybody else?
I don't disagree. I'm just getting your opinion on it.
Yeah. I'm like I said, it's there has never been any, there's lots and lots of bloviating and lots of theorizing about the minimum wage doing all kinds of evil, but there are no examples. And the minimum wage has been around through my lifetime, my father's lifetime, my grandfather's lifetime, and I guarantee you, if there was an example, it would be, if there was a smoking gun, it would be waved around by every Republican in Congress every single night until we could all chant it like a mantra. David, thank you for the call. Joe in Chicago. Hey, Joe, we only have a minute left in the show. You got a quick one?
I wish I had more time, but I'll try and make it quick. I was glad to hear you talk about the monetary system. I do want to make a couple of points. You talked about fiat money, and right. I don't know if you intoned it that way, but you talked about maybe fiat money like it's a bad thing.
No, I think fiat money is a good thing. I think that the gold standard is a problem because if the economy grows or shrinks, you have to alter the amount of gold you have in order to accommodate it. And if you don't, you have currency chaos, which is why we had currency chaos in the United States through most of the late 19th and early 20th centuries.
Yeah, well, most people don't realize that with fiat money, it's only by law. And the coin money, which is real money, is fiat money also.
Yes.
The basic problem of the Federal Reserve money, as you said, it's promissory notes. Our entire system is based on loan money.
Well, yes, and I think that's the biggest problem, is that we have a debt-based monetary system, and that's something that Ellen Brown is a genius about. Joe, I'm sorry, we're flat out of time, but Web of Debt is a great website, and it's also a great book if you really want to learn this stuff. Coming up tomorrow, of course, it's Friday. That can only mean brunch with Bernie. America's Senator Bernie Sanders will be here. Wouldn't it be great if one day he was America's president, taking your calls? And anything goes Friday. Your turn to choose this topic, what's on your mind. Don't forget democracy is not a spectator sport. Tag, you're it.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. EdisonFactor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.